Our scripture reading this morning comes from the book of Matthew. Please find Matthew chapter 7. We'll be reading verses 1 through 12. Matthew 7, verses 1 through 12. This is the word of our God. Do not judge so that you will not be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite. First take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Do not give what is holy to dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine, or they will trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds. And to him who knocks, it will be opened. Or what man is there among you who, when his son asks for a loaf, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, you will not give him a snake, will he? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give what is good to those who ask him? In everything, therefore, treat people the same way you want them to treat you, for this is the law and the prophets. The word of our God, it stands forever.
Thank you, John. Last week we made a special announcement as we get going here this morning. We announced that we're going to, shall we say, get on a somewhat faster course here through the book of Ecclesiastes. Seth Brown will be preaching and teaching during the month of June. I'll be out of the pulpit, but I won't be out of work. You'll recall that's when I'm going to become snooping around. Please don't think of it that way. But as I mentioned last week, we wanted to get into everybody's home here in this church. One time last year, we never got it done, but we'll get it done this year. And I appreciate the help from the pulpit that we'll be receiving. And Seth will be speaking on the fall of Jerusalem, a key event that is referenced in Scripture again and again. Might be one of the most ignored events, at least in the New Testament, quite frankly. And we will not ignore it. You'll hear it about it in June, and the wonderful application of that event, because it is certainly referenced in the Bible often enough. And then I mentioned that I'll be beginning the book of Revelation in July. And I'm excited about that. It just amazes me how important this book is and how we've treated it. We've taken a book that's called The Revelation of Jesus Christ, which shows a very active Jesus Christ in heaven, extremely active, acting. And we've taken the entire book and made it inactive. We made it into a book that we observe like through a glass case. And we just kind of stare at it and say, isn't that interesting? But Revelation reveals a Christ. It's the revelation of Jesus Christ who is acting in history. Can't wait to get there. But before we do that, we had a little bump in the road last week, which I have to address. Question came up during the question time. How is it Christ dies on Friday, rises again, we say, on Sunday? And then the question came up, well, how's it work that just like Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, how's it all work? How do you do that? And so I did a little bit of a study on that this week, and I'm pretty thrilled about the results of that study. And it's just too much to go into in a short while. So the first week in July, I'm going to address that question. It is a question that needs to be addressed because Christ himself said to his disciples that the chief priests and scribes will crucify him and he'll be dead and buried and he'll raise the third day, not the fourth day. So how do you get rising again the third day and still be 3 days and three nights in the grave and rise the third day? It seems like he should be rising the fourth day if he's in the grave 3 days and three nights. Well, we will we'll straighten it all out for you, and we will definitely address that the first week in July, and then we'll get to then we'll get to Revelation. But it's an important question because it definitely comes up, and I was thrilled with my study because I think it gave for me an even more of a wonderful idea of what Christ actually went through for us. We tend to think it's the cross only, but it was not. It was a lot more going on there. Well, we just read this morning a passage that, at least the beginning part of it, is pretty much known not only by most Christians, but most unbelievers. Pretty much most unbelievers know pretty much two verses in the Bible. First verse is, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone." You'll run into that one. And the second one is, "Judge not, you be not judged." Don't judge. Well, why are we addressing this with what Solomon talks about here in Ecclesiastes? Well, I believe we have a little bit of context here. And let's talk about those first five verses and how badly we miss the point. It says, "Judge not, you be not judged," so you're not supposed to ever judge anyone. But then Christ says there, "And when you look at the speck in your brother's eye, do not consider the plank in your own eye." And of course, the whole point is that if you're going to help your brother get out the speck in his eye, you need to be able to see clearly. Translation, you need to be able to judge. This should be obvious. Then he says, "Hypocrite," verse 5, "first remove the plank from your own eye." And Christ there is pointing out the foolishness of trying to help someone else out of their situation when you've got the same one. And here Christ is, if ever, he's pointing out that you must be able to practice what you preach. Your life must be able to back up what you say. Otherwise, your words are wasted. In fact, even do more harm, quite frankly. And look at verse 6. Talk about not judging. Verse 6. "Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under your feet and turn and tear you in pieces." And I think when he says trample them under their feet, I think he's talking about the pigs. And when he says turn and tear you in pieces, he's talking about the dogs. Now, it almost goes without saying, but not quite, that if we're going to be able to identify swine or pigs and dogs, we might know how to judge. But then he says this, "Ask and it will be given to you, seeking you will find, knock and it will be opened to you." What's that talking about? "For everyone who asks receives." How do we go to judging there, to asking and so forth? "For what man is there?" And I think verse 9, I think we're getting to his conclusion here. I think all that goes before actually gets wrapped up there in verse 12. Let's read that. "What man is there among you, if his son asks for bread, will he give him a stone? If he asks for a fish, will he give him a serpent? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts," and that's our key here this morning, "to your children, how much more will your Father, who is in heaven, give good things to those who ask him?" Therefore, there he's wrapping that up here. This is critical. "Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets." Our sermon title this morning is "The Solomon's Antidote to Depression is Thanksgiving." And our idea this morning is be thankful for whatever gifts God has given to you. You see, the point here, I think, of what Christ is saying is this. One of the reasons why you have to be able to be discerning, and yes, be able to judge things, is to be able to know how to give good gifts. We have Christ here saying that God knows how to give good gifts. And you people being evil, you're people that are sinful, you even can figure out how to give a good gift to your son. And if God will even give himself, he'll give the Holy Spirit to those who ask. But the problem is we don't always recognize the good gifts, do we? That's our problem. And when he says, therefore, you know, do to others as you would do to them, what he's saying here in the context is, among other things, know how to give good gifts to other people. Because God gives good gifts. You see, there's context here. You know, we hear people say, you've heard this all the time, every religion has a golden rule. And of course, the golden rule gets to be judged by us, right? So, do to me what I would like to do to you, and if I'm into great sin, then allow me to be in great sin, because I would allow you to be in great sin. And that's how it's interpreted apart from this context. Interestingly enough, it's often said that the golden rule here is some kind of a new thing. Never heard of that before Christ came, did we? Who ever heard of the golden rule? And Christ slams that one when he says, this is the law and the prophets. This is nothing new. We've had this the whole time. The law and the prophets the whole time. Because whatever you do, as you would that men would do to you, do also to them likewise. That ultimately has to do with the good gifts that God gives to us, which most of the time we aren't interested in. With that in mind, let's turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. We saw last week that Solomon here is asking you in the presence of God to watch what you say. And we talked about the fact that you can make a vow before God, it becomes real public and everybody knows about it, and then you don't keep it, and then it's sinful for you. And oftentimes that can be a show-offy type of thing. We know that kind of thing happened in the New Testament. When Christ said, hey, when you fast, do it secretly. You don't need this big public show for everybody to see what a great guy you are. Same way with praying, a real elaborate prayer in public. And then we get to verse 8. And we're going to be going through today chapter 5 and verse 8 all the way through chapter 6. Like I said, we are in a sprint through Ecclesiastes. But let's read this. If you see, this is verse 8 of chapter 5, if you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter, for high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all, even the king is served from the field. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This is also vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them, so what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. And as he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And this is also a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink, and to enjoy the good of his labor, in which he toils under the sun. All the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on all the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all his desires, yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, and it is an evil affliction. If a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he, for it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though it is not the sun, though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice, but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place. All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet his soul is not satisfied. For what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Whatever one is has been named already, for it is known that he is man, and he cannot contend with him who is mightier than he. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? For who knows what is good for man in life, all the days of his vain life which he passes like a shadow? Who can tell a man what will become, what will happen to him after? Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? It's going to sound a little bit to us like Solomon is back into his depression. In the weeks that we've seen, it seems like in chapter 4 and chapter 5, it doesn't seem like he's as discouraged and, shall we say, down in the mouth, if you will, as he was. It sounds like he was getting out of it. It sounds like he's in the house of God here, and he understands that God is greater than he is, especially in verses 1 through 7 of chapter 5. But now it seems like he's going back to where he was before. But ultimately, I believe, as we'll see, that the key verses here in this section are verses 18 and 19, where Solomon once again talks about something that is actually good. Now, we'll get to that in just a minute, but before we do that, I want to talk about some things that we need to notice about these two chapters here. First of all, in the beginning of chapter 5, we looked at this last week, but we want to look at this, or just mention it today. Solomon, for the first time in beginning of chapter 5, begins to talk in the second person. He begins to talk to his hearers. A little bit unusual because he calls himself the preacher up to this point. And this is the first time, really, that he begins to preach in the normal way we understand preaching, if you will. He's talking to his, he says, walk prudently, and grammarians in the congregation today will understand that when you have a sentence like this, an imperative like this, the subject is you. You is not mentioned in the passage. It doesn't say you walk prudently, but that's still the subject here. Grammarians will understand this. I'm not a grammarian, but even I remember this from studying in this school when I attended. You walk prudently when you go to the house of God. He begins to talk in the second person for the first time. Up till now, it's been some wise things that he said, and mostly like, I saw this, and I did that, and I pursued this, and it was my labor, and it's all a complete disaster. So that's our first point. Just something to notice. Again, he seems to return to his depression in 5:13. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to their hurt. Verse 16, and this is also a severe evil. Chapter 6 and verse 1, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun. And it seems like he's struggling once again. And I think there's, I have two explanations for this. The first explanation is that it may be, let's remember, this is an emotional book here. We tend to approach the scriptures often enough as if every book was written by Paul, shall we say. And Paul reasons his way through like Romans and Ephesians. And he goes from one point to the next and he keeps building. Ecclesiastes is not that way as much. You know, when you have an emotional book, emotions don't just switch, do they? Somebody's just going to say, I'm discouraged. I'm really, really down. And someone comes along and says, well, think happy thoughts. So, oh, I wish I would have thought of that. That just changes everything. Discouragement and depression, it often takes time. I compare it to forgiveness. Have you ever really had to forgive someone? I've heard people say, oh, well, just forgive them. Well, I got news for you. Depending on the severity of what happened, you don't just forgive people. Have you ever had to do that? You don't just forgive. You forgive again and again and again. You forgive, yes, you do, and then the thoughts come back in your head, and then in your mind, you're destroying them again, whether it's through words or worse in your mind, and you realize, you know what, I have to forgive again. And you have to forgive again and again and again. You don't just forgive, oh, yeah, thanks, I didn't thought of that. Yeah, I'll forgive and go on my merry way. And generally speaking, the worse the offense, the longer it takes to forgive, and the more often you have to do it. It's not just, oh, I forgive, and on. Anybody who ever tells you that hasn't forgiven anyone. Understand that. I think we have a similar thing here, perhaps. Solomon is working his way out, but now he's going back again. He's seeing these things that are going on, and it's making him angry. It's making him disgusted. He's trying to move on, but he can't stop what he sees. That's one explanation. It's taking some time for him to get out of his depression, or discouragement, if you will. Or secondly, he is once again reacting to the frustration of seeing a man separated from the good of all his labor. We said that happened before in chapter 4. We saw that oppressive people and envious people, you remember? They will attack a man just for doing good things. We talked about many people who do good things. We talked about the idea that oftentimes we say, hey, you know what? If you do good things, people will love you and they'll appreciate you and they'll just say, hey, what a great guy he is. We read the Matthew Henry quote saying, you know what? When you do good things, it makes wicked people even more upset with you. And they want to bring you down. And Solomon talked about that in chapter 4. Talked about the people that want to separate a person from the fruit of his labor. And then the other people, they're just lazy and sitting on their hands. And they get envious of the guy who, or woman, if you will, who works hard and turns a profit. Well, I think the same thing could be happening here. Because what Solomon talks about in verse 8 of chapter 5 through all chapter 6, he talks about the frustration of a person once again not being able to connect with the fruit of his labor. And as I studied that, as I've mentioned before here, when you study the Bible, you know, and you want to communicate it, and then sometimes you come up with things that you just don't see in other places and in other commentaries. And it makes you a little bit insecure about what you're going to say on Sunday morning. It's like, why is anybody else saying this? I'm 59 years old. I don't even know. I know this much Greek and less Hebrew. So how's this work? But I want you to listen to what I'm saying this morning and evaluate what I'm saying and judge it by the rest of the book. The third thing, I'll come back to that. The third thing that I want you to notice this morning is this section here is where he will talk about the evil under the sun. And when he mentions those verses, verse 13, severe evil, verse 16, severe evil, and then of chapter 5, and then chapter 6 and verse 1, an evil which I've seen under the sun. It's in this section that this is pretty much the last time he will say these kinds of things. Notice that because as we go forward, his tune is going to change rather drastically. And I believe what's happening is he's changing his perspective. From his perspective, let's face it, folks, from his perspective and his perspective alone, there is a lot of evil in the world. And there's a lot of horrible things going on. And anybody who watches the CBS Evening News, probably no one in this room, will understand this. But his perspective actually changes from his to God's. And I think that's one of the reasons why we see that kind of language disappear, pretty much disappear after this chapter, after chapter 6. This entire section for our fourth point here that I want you to notice, I believe, is connected to the two key verses, 18 and 19. He talks about all the evil. A severe evil, verse 13. Severe evil, verse 16. And evil, again. But in the middle of that, right in the center of that, he talks about something good. Here's what I've seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink. So in the middle of the evil, he's talking about something good. And that's a theme that he's talked about throughout the entire chapter or entire book. And we'll return to that in just a moment. One other thing I want you to know, a notice, if you will, and that is that the word for laboring in verse 12 is the same as the word prophet in verse 9. Now, when it says the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, that's not the same word that he uses in the rest of the book. For example, verse 18, it is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labor. That's a different word than what we see verse 12. And I point that out because the sleep there of a laboring man is sweet, and the profit of the land, that seems to be the idea of working for a definite reward that's in view, and something that is not entirely all-consuming to you. The sleep of a laboring man being sweet. But the other labor here that he talks about, and he talks about throughout the entire book, is a word. It does mean to work hard, but it also has the idea of just sort of being more of an all-consuming desire type thing that is connected with many frustrations and at the same time many rewards. Because oftentimes the harder you work towards something, the sweeter it is when you achieve it. It's one of the reasons why state-sponsored welfare is such a disaster and looked upon so with such disdain even by those who receive it. They haven't worked for it. And we'll talk about that in verse 18. And that's what I want to talk about next here. I want to talk about verses 18 and 19 and how we have a key here, I think, to the entire, at least this entire section, if not the entire book. Look at what Solomon says. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives. It's a gift which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, he receives his heritage and rejoices in his labor. This is the gift of God. So, Solomon sees something good in the midst of all this evil, and that is the connection between a man being able to labor and the man being able to enjoy the fruit of his labor. Now, if you think you've heard this before, it's because you have. Solomon is not getting off of this point. And we said before that it is indeed a severe evil to separate a man from the fruit of his labor. I am very surprised that all the folks that talk, even from a Christian standpoint, of the market and capitalism versus socialism, all these kinds of things, I'm very surprised that we don't use these verses from Ecclesiastes a lot more than we do. Because Solomon has been on this theme. If you've been with us through the study, he's been on this theme again and again. Now, why is it that Solomon can't get off this theme? You know, I see all this bad stuff in the world, but here's one good thing. A man enjoying the fruit of his labor, it's a gift of God. What? How does that sound spiritual to you? I mean, shouldn't he be saying, what I've seen is that people get out there with the four spiritual laws? Well, here's the thing about that. Solomon here, I believe, is at the very, very beginning. And it is a good thing, by the way, to speak to your neighbor about his need for Christ. And your non-neighbor, and whoever you can. That's very, very good. But how can you even do it If you're starving to death, you're not even alive. What am I saying here? Let's look at this verse. Here's what I have seen. It is good and fitting. I think King James says, KJV says comely, fitting for one to eat and drink. Really? Do you mean to tell me that when you go home and sit over dinner with your family, and you eat and you drink, that's a good thing? No, that's a neutral thing, see? The only thing good we really, really do is when we're out like having some special serving Jesus some kind of way. You know the list. A missionary, if a missionary eats and drinks, then that's better because he's eating and drinking so he can like witness to people. But the rest of us regular stiffs, when we go just work a job and we eat and drink, we're not really all that spiritual. Not what Solomon's talking about here. He's talking about eating and drinking, and that's a good thing. Let's get away from this two-tier idea. You know, it really is Roman Catholicism, my friends. That's where it comes from. The priests and the monks, that's why the monks, they got away from the world. Right? Because they were extra spiritual. And those other poor stiffs that were like plowing their land or building a house, they weren't really spiritual. Because it's not really spiritual to build a house, you know, and to plow your ground. Solomon says right here, it is good and fitting. It's appropriate. It's the right thing for you to go home and eat and drink in your house as a result of your labor, and it's a good thing. Not a neutral thing, a good one. Moving on. And to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun. Are you supposed to feel guilty that God has given you these gifts? I've known folks like that. I knew one dear lady. She had a really beautiful house. And she was always talking about how she's going to use it for Bible study. You know, and it seemed like the only way she could justify her house was because she was going to use it for Bible study. Well, I got news for you. Most of the world today is living in a house that is 100th as beautiful as your house is right now. Do you feel guilty? Or do you only feel guilty if it's better than your neighbor's? You know what? Stop feeling guilty. If what you have is the result of your labor, stop feeling guilty because right here we know it's a gift of God. Enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life. Why? Because God gives it, it's his heritage. Now that word heritage gives us a little bit of trouble. Some people want to say it's his lot in life. But that same word is used, for example, where David says, "You are my portion, O Lord." It's the same word here. I don't think we say that the Lord is our lot in life. I think this word heritage is a good word here. And then verse 19 actually transitions, as we'll see in a moment, to chapter 6. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, he receives his heritage and rejoices in his labor. This is the gift of God. I want to be really clear on this morning, my friends. If God has given you good things, and he has, how do I know that? Well, you were born here, weren't you? Why weren't you born in some sub-Saharan African country, forced to join a army at the age of 9 and hacked to death by machetes at age 12. Why not? Was it something good that you did? Or is that all a gift of God, everything? Being born here, the blessings you've enjoyed. And while you may not have enjoyed as many blessings as your neighbor, perhaps, all of us can say that, you still have been the recipient, just by being here this morning, mostly free from hassle. Most of us did not get out of bed concerned that we were going to be killed today. These are gifts from God. And don't feel guilty about God's good gifts. Because I believe that's an insult to God to feel guilty about the gifts he's given to us. Now, Now, what about the rest of the passage, though? And we want to come back and apply this. Well, let's see how he's broken this up. This is very depressing to him. If you see the oppression, verse 8, and we'll just quickly go through the passage, and then we'll apply it, and then we'll be finished. If you see the oppression of the poor, the violent perversion of justice, that word violent there is critical here, the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter, for high official watches over high official, and high officials are over them. Now, what's he saying here? He could be saying two things. He could be saying, well, don't worry about it, because high officials are looking over high officials, and they're going to straighten out the situation. That's what I'd like it to mean. I don't think that's what it means. I think he's saying it's a whole lot worse than what you think. You see violent perversion of justice and righteousness, and all these high officials are looking over it, and they're all in on it. And nobody's stopping it. No wonder he's depressed. And then he makes a real simple point that connects to it. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all. Even the king is served from the field. Hey, Solomon's making a point here. I think he's making it to officials. Hey, you guys think that you're somebody just because you're a high official? You aren't producing anything. It's the people that are out there working, getting their hands dirty, plowing the fields and harvesting the fields and building the houses and really creating jobs for their neighbor, serving their neighbor through their labor. They're the ones that are profiting everyone else and, frankly, profiting you, king. You ever see a politician do that? Advertise in his promotional literature that he's creating jobs. They're destroying jobs. Creating, what are they, hiring people? What are they, producing something that their neighbor wants? See, that's what creates jobs, right? Serving your neighbor through making his life easier or better in some way. That's what produces jobs. Solomon's point is this. You have all this oppression going on out there. All of it. And the kings themselves that are all involved in this oppression and see what's going on. All these high officials. And you see the bureaucracy here. This is another tremendous point I think that we miss. We've missed this. We've run into this tremendous bureaucracy here. And we've set up this bureaucracy to try to protect us. And that's exactly what it's not doing. See the bureaucracy here? High official watches over high official and the higher officials even over them. Did you see it? We've got quite a layer of all kinds of officials, and you know what they're doing? They're watching each other. Pretty much what they do. Except when they get nosy and start to bug you and I. All involved in the wickedness. Solomon points out to them, you guys aren't really producing anything. You're producing nothing. It's the people out in the field that are producing something even for you so you guys can eat. Then he goes on to say, talk about working, laboring for the sake of labor itself, or for the sake of individual gain. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This is also vanity. I just want more. I believe that's the Rockefeller quote, right? When he was asked how much is enough. Just a little more, and a little more, and a little more. You see, if you're working and laboring not to serve Christ and not to love your neighbor, who are you working for then? There's only three possibilities. Working for Christ and your neighbor, or for you. And Solomon's saying here, there's no profit in just working for you because you're never going to be satisfied. You see, he's contrasting the dissatisfaction in verses 10 and 11 with the satisfaction we see in verses 18 and 19. You see that? In verse 12, we referenced already, this is a verse I have my personal list of things that I just really hate. One thing I hate that lottery thing. I hate it with a passion. Because it's telling people that you can profit without work. It's telling people that there is such a thing as a privilege without a responsibility. To me, the lottery, maybe it's a little strong, and maybe I'm off the edge a little bit. To me, the lottery is to working and serving your neighbor what living together is to marriage. Living together says, I can have the privileges and I don't need the responsibility. That's what that's about. The lottery is the same thing. I can make all this money without any kind of responsibility. And it's a hateful thing. And I wish, if there was a verse, if someone said, okay, Joel, since you hate the lottery so much, you're allowed one verse to put up with all those billboards that encourage you to play the lottery. They should be able to let me do that, right? Because they already have their little blurb, proceeds benefit senior citizens. See, it assuages my guilt, right? I'm guilty for playing the lottery for wasting the money, but hey, I'm benefiting some senior citizens someplace. Raise your hand if you know a senior citizen who's been benefited by the lottery. What a nonsensical thing. So, give me my little phrase, right? And my little phrase would be this one right here. This is the verse I would put up. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. You think you're going to solve all your problems with your lottery win? And by the way, it's not talked about much, but sometime, if you get a chance, read up on lottery winners. Most of the time, it's not a very pretty picture, just exactly what Solomon is saying here. And you could have saved yourself an awful lot of problems if you just would have read what Solomon has to say. Now he gets in verse 13 to a severe evil. We'll try to pick up the pace here a little bit, which he's seen under the sun. And this evil, it talks about riches, riches kept for their owner to his hurt, but those riches perish through misfortune, and he's separated through his own wickedness from the labor of his hands. And by the time he's done, he's built up all these riches. And then when he goes, verse 16, he goes just the way he came with nothing, and he's labored for the wind. And all he has to show for all of his efforts is verse 17. All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. That's a way to live, isn't it? Now don't you wish you could be this guy? All kinds of goods, and it doesn't get what's really valuable to him, and all he has is darkness, sorrow, sickness, and anger. It's hard to imagine four more nasty words, if you will, especially applied to someone who should be better off. And his whole life is this. Solomon, once again, underlying the fact, you want money just for money's sake? Guess what? You're never going to be satisfied, and it might make you worse off. The good guy in here is the laboring guy. Whether he's little or much. That little or much thing is interesting to me. I can relate to that a little bit. I still remember, I might have mentioned before, when there were times when money was really tight, and it was just a huge, you know, anti-GMO people, don't crucify me for this. It was a huge thing for us to go to McDonald's, to our family. It was just big. We just didn't do that. We couldn't. Don't feel sorry for me. I still lived in a house without a leaky roof that had indoor plumbing and all kinds of electrical appliances. So I was still rich, and we were still rich, very rich, compared to most of the people in the world. But what happened was things eventually turned a little bit. We got a little better. And then it wasn't quite so exciting to go to McDonald's. That became a little ho-hum. And to get the same thrill that we had before to go to McDonald's, we had to go to a place a little better now. You see, what I needed was to be thankful to God for whatever gifts he gave us to begin with. That's the antidote. And that's the antidote that Solomon needs and is giving it to us here. So in verses 8 through 14, 17, It's the man himself through his own wrong belief system, scooping up all these things for himself, not being concerned about Christ or his neighbor, ending his days in sorrow, sickness, and anger. But chapter 6 is a little bit different picture. This is also going to be a man that's going to be separated from his goods, but for a different reason. And this is a little bit more difficult for us. And this is going to require us to understand that the gifts of God are really gifts, and we really don't earn them, and it really is grace alone, and it's not some kind of like quid pro quo thing going between us and God. And this is hard to see, it's going to be a hard truth for us, but we need to understand, we need to get it. Look at what this, we can't get away from this. Look at what this says. There's an evil which I have seen under the sun, and is common among men. Common among men. A man to whom God has given riches. Okay, so the riches came from God, and wealth and honor. It's not bad. Some people aren't happy with just riches. So it looks like wealth and honor. So not only are you rich, but everybody seems to love you. So that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires. Yet God, the same God, does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, and it is an evil affliction. So, who's giving him the gifts? God. At the same time, who is not giving him the ability to enjoy it, but gives it to a foreigner? God. Let's read it again. Verses 1 and 2. There's an evil which I've seen under the sun and is common among men. A man whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires, yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity and it is an evil affliction. And then he goes on to talk about the man's fame. He begets 100 children, many years. His soul is satisfied with goodness. But indeed he has no burial. And see, this is something that the man himself cannot control. This is up to God. He has no burial. People forget about him that quickly. He says, a stillborn child is better than thee, because a stillborn child doesn't see all this goodness that God does not ultimately allow him to enjoy. Verse 7, all his labor, all the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet his soul is not satisfied. For what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? I think that poor man actually harks back to the previous chapter, the sleep of a laboring man. Better in the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. And what's that talking about? The sight of the eyes and wandering of desire. Meaning that God still has not allowed him to enjoy the fruit of his labor. Now, verse 12, we'll skip that a little bit. For who knows what is good for a man in life, all the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow. What can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? So Solomon is contrasting two things here. Once again, he's back to that idea of what's going to happen to my goods after I've accumulated them. But he's also going to another point here early in the chapter. Even while he's alive, God does not give him the ability to enjoy his goods. Now, my friends, I cannot tell you, I can't even begin to explain to you why. Why in the world God would give a person goods and then not give him the ability to enjoy it. I don't know why that is. But we remember in Isaiah it says that my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither my ways your ways, saith the Lord. Now, the reason why I think Solomon is saying this is he's underlining the fact that the ability to work and have things, to eat and drink, is really what he's talking about. Be able to eat, be able to drink. That's a gift from God, and the ability to work is a gift from God, and the ability to enjoy it is a gift of God. And he's getting us away from the idea that just because God gives us anything at all doesn't mean that he has an obligation to allow us to enjoy it. It really is a gift, all of it. And that's his point in chapter 6. And if you ever get discouraged because things aren't the way you think they should be, I hope you'll go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 6 and just think a little bit on all the blessings God has given you and all the blessings you do and have enjoyed. Because Solomon's making the point here, God doesn't owe you this. And it's a tough passage. It's very difficult. But that's precisely what it says. And that's what Solomon is complaining about. Now, back to verses 18 and 19. What's this mean to us? How do we apply this? It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him for his heritage. I'm going to apply this more to Solomon than I am to us, but I think you'll see the point. As I was preparing this sermon, I went through a book that I have at home, and I actually wanted to bring it this morning, but I didn't. It's called Tyrants. And it's about like 100 various tyrants the world has seen. And it's kind of amazing how you can just flip from page to page to page and see guys who were serious mass murderers. I mean, serious. Guys who would burn down a house, or burn down one particular guy. He didn't want what we would call the disabled in his kingdom. He didn't want poor people in his kingdom either. He wanted to be a king of successful people. So he had a plan. He didn't give him a hard time. He just told him he'd throw a big feast. Which he did. And huge feast. All the poor people, all the people that are lame, blind, sick, they all came. Came to his feast. And they ate, they drank, he got them all good and drunk. They asked him at some point, he says, how would you like for all your troubles to be over? They said, sure. So he burnt down the entire building and killed them all. Page after page after page of people doing this, attacking cities, burning them, killing everything that moved. Page after page after page. Now, what does this have to do with this? I think Solomon here is laying out, at a minimum, not only for us, but for all the kings that come after him. What is the job of a king? Here's why I'm saying this. You remember in the beginning of the book, he calls himself the preacher, and he says he was king in Jerusalem. So he's going to tell us somewhere in this book what a king is supposed to do and be. If you're a preacher and a king, you're going to eventually preach to kings. And while it doesn't say that he's preaching to kings here, it certainly applies. And what I'm able to find out myself as I study great wicked men, and just find them everywhere, a wise and a gracious king is the exception and not the rule. The rule is wicked people who kill lots and lots and lots of people, which we've seen in the 20th century, and is still going on. Where oppression really starts, and this is my point, it starts with attacking your neighbor's goods. You see, when a tyrant comes along, a real wicked king, he doesn't start out by killing everybody. He starts out by attacking their goods and taking the stuff that belongs to them. He starts by attacking their labor. And here's a point for any civil magistrate. A number one point, this is the first point, not the last, but it's the first point. The first job of a civil magistrate is to make sure that the people that he's responsible for are connecting their labor with the rewards of those labor. If the civil magistrate will protect that, then he'll never graduate on to killing people. If I could, I would take this verse to every civil magistrate everywhere and just ask him, what are you doing to make sure the people under your jurisdiction are connected to their labor? And what are you doing to attack the fruits of their labor and harvest it for yourself? What are you doing? See, this is one of the reasons why we don't have this bureaucracy that Solomon talked about in verse 8. You don't see that in the Old Testament Israelites. You see godly, honest men out in the gates adjudicating disputes, and guess what? Because they're so successful in business, they have that extra time to do those kinds of things, and the people are not paying all kinds of layers and layers of bureaucrats. You can't believe the layers of bureaucrats you and I pay for today. Under God's system, you didn't do that. It was their job to make sure that the laborer, being worthy of his hire, Christ says in the New Testament, that they were connected. This, I would argue, right here, 18 and 19, is the beginning point for all kings, all civil magistrates, all in authority. That's how we should judge them. Yeah. Yeah, we should judge them. That's why we have a Bible, is it not? Because if we don't have a Bible, we have no judge for the civil magistrate, because the only judgment we have left is power. And power is not a good judge. The Word of God is a good judge. Shall we pray? We thank you, Lord, that you have so much given us the ability to work and allowed us to enjoy that work, the fruit of that labor, and yes, that work itself as well. What a gift. May we remember this, O Lord, when we feel like and start to believe that somehow we've gotten a bad deal in life. Help us always to remember you've really given us a lot of gifts. You've allowed us to work to gain those gifts, and you've allowed us to enjoy it. And that is a gift from you by your grace alone, and not by anything we've done. May we never forget it. It's in Christ's name we pray it. Amen.